This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Religious differences feed conflicts around the world. Religion writer Bruce Feiler says part of the path to peace is for Jews, Christians, and Muslims to acknowledge their shared heritage and their roots in the story of Abraham. In a speech earlier this year, Feiler said the goal is not to gloss over theological differences, but to speak openly about them. It's Feiler's speech on the three religions of Abraham that we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Bruce Feiler is author of Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths, and most recently author of Where God Was Born. He may be familiar to public TV viewers as host of the series Walking the Bible, which was based on his book of the same name, the one that set him on the path of writing about religion. Feiler's appearance at the Chautauqua Institution this summer was part of a whole week of discussions on the story of Abraham. Here, then, best-selling religion writer Bruce Feiler and his speech at the Chautauqua Institution in Western New York State.
As some of you may know, back earlier in the winter, President Bush was interviewed by C-SPAN and kind of asked at the end of this interview in a somewhat boilerplate question, well, what books have you read lately? And the next day I got a call from my father saying, the President of the United States just mispronounced your name on international television. So I would go into this meeting, right, and my wife goes, and my parents come up from Georgia, and, you know, we all get, I played it for all it's worth, got my suit pressed, my shoes shined, I mean, the whole thing. And we expected kind of ceremony and maybe even kind of, you know, kind of towel snapping. Instead, we had this, to our surprise, I was 20-minute very, I mean, Nancy Gibbs is coming on Friday, very serious conversation. The first words out of his mouth actually were about Iraq, which was interesting. We're in a time of history, and history will judge us in Iraq. I was in Iraq, as some of you know from my most recent book. And then I took the occasion to ask him about faith, since he had led with seriousness. And then what followed was a very interesting 20-minute conversation about church and state. And a couple times he asked that his remarks be kept private, but I would say that the overall kind of tenor, I feel comfortable saying, of the conversation was really about the separation of church and state and how he doesn't feel vain enough to be called by God, but he wants to serve God. But more to the point, I thought this is what's interesting and relevant to what you're going to do here this week. He said, I don't believe he has a Bible, for example, in the Oval Office, but said he doesn't read it in the Oval Office. He said, I don't think it's our role to my role to impose my faith on the country. This is not a Christian nation. It's the Islamic extremists who impose their faith on others, and our strength as America is that we respect different faiths. Now, regardless of what you may think of that, I think what's interesting, it was very profound, and to me, one of the more profound things about it is that's actually not what he was saying earlier when he was first running back in 2000. And I think that, to me, what I took away from my experience in the Oval Office was, counter to what you hear that it's the most isolated place on earth, was that it's not isolated. In fact, he's hearing what's going on in the country, both about Iraq and about so many other things, but also about this issue of dialogue. He brought up Tony Blair. He brought up building institutions in the Palestinian territories. He specifically brought up the strength of America as an interfaith place. And to me, that was a very striking example of how far the interfaith conversation has come. What I thought I would do here is basically take a step back and talk a little bit about how I ended up unexpectedly in the middle of that conversation. I had this experience recently of going to get to the library to get out what turned out to be the April 8, 1966 edition of Time. It was black and had three red words on the cover. And for those of you who are students of such things, it was the first issue in the history of Time magazine that did not have a person on it. And those three red words, of course, were, "Is God dead?" Now, the topic of that article was that God had retreated from contemporary life and religion was dead as a matter of influence in world affairs and would never return again. Oops. What a difference 40 years can make. What are the biggest international stories of our time? Iraq, Afghanistan, war in Israel, this time last summer, in two fronts, terrorism. What are the biggest domestic stories of our time? Scandal in the Catholic Church, crisis in the Episcopal Church, gay marriage, Ten Commandments, Terri Schiavo, stem cells. What's the biggest movie of the last few years? The Passion of the Christ. What's the biggest book in the last few years? Actually, maybe the last 25 years? The Da Vinci Code. And what are these all about? Of course, they are about religion. And in particular, they are about the relationship among religion, politics, and each of our everyday struggles with both of these issues. And so what I want to talk about here today is that relationship. And let me just, as I said, take a step back and talk about how I ended up in this conversation. I'm a fifth-generation Jew from the American South, and I grew up in Savannah, Georgia. And over the first decade of my, back in my 20s, of my professional life, I traveled around the world and entered various cultures, Japan, England, country music, and as I said earlier, it's true, I did spend a year performing as a clown in the Clyde Beatty Kohler Brothers Circus. And about 10 years ago now, I decided that I wanted to reread the Bible. I hadn't read it since I was a kid, which meant I hadn't really read it. So I took the Bible off my shelf, I put it by my bed, where it promptly sat for two years, gathering dust and making me feel even guiltier. And then I went to visit an old friend who was living in Jerusalem. And let me interrupt myself. Who here's been to Israel, to the Middle East, maybe to Egypt? Wow. So on my first day, I did what a lot of people do on their first day. I went to this promenade overlooking the city. And this friend of mine said, over there is this controversial neighborhood, and over there is the rock where Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac. And it just struck me, you mean these are real places that you can touch and visit and feel? This crazy way I live my life, I thought, well, here's an idea. What if I travel along the route and read the Bible along the way? Few people thought this was a good idea. Everywhere I went, people tried to talk me out of it. Most of those places are unsafe. Many of them are in war zones. There's no archaeological evidence that any of these events ever took place. And that was before I told my mother. But once this idea took root in my head, I was not going to be dissuaded. I went back, found this archaeologist, and we made this journey. It took about a year. It was 10,000 miles, three continents, five countries, four war zones. We would go to the place up Mount Ararat looking for Noah's Ark, across the Red Sea, and to the burning bush and the Sinai. And then we would read the stories in the places. Walking the Bible, as so many of you know, came out in the spring of 2001 and became, as you just heard, this fantasy that all writers have of a book that touches people around the world. And as many of you know, I went back and I retraced it for this PBS series that first came out last year. And I should say, and I kind of feel obliged to point this out, that the good news about Walking the Bible on PBS was that it was one of the highest rated shows on PBS in years. And as a result of that, PBS has been expressing its appreciation as only PBS can, with endless re-airings as part of pledge drives. So, again, a consumer tip. If you roll over in the middle of the night and turn on your TV, you may see me wagging my finger and saying you should support your local public television station. 6 months later came 9/11. And I was in New York that morning and watched the towers fall from my home. And as you all recall, in those weeks afterwards, we began to hear these questions. Who are they? Why do they hate us? And can the religions get along? And particularly for someone who spent so much time in the Middle East, one name echoed behind those conversations. One man stood at the heart of all three religions who suddenly seemed to be at war. Abraham. 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 He's the shared ancestor of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. That's 14 million Jews, 2 billion Christians, and 1 billion Muslims around the world. That's half the humans alive today. And yet, he's virtually unknown. Consider this the most famous story of Abraham's life, the scene where he nearly sacrifices his son to God. You'd think that that story was so barbaric, it would have died out over time. Instead, Jews read that story in the holiest week of their year, Rosh Hashanah. Christians read that story, the same story, in the holiest week of their year, at Easter. And Muslims read that story, the same story, in the holiest week of their year, during the Hajj. Why is that? Because, I suggest, it asks the question that none of us fears, none of us dares to ask, and touches at the root of so many of the challenges in the world today. Would I kill for God? And for many people around the world, the answer to that question is still yes. And so 2 weeks after 9/11, I got up off my couch and I went back to the Middle East. I went back to the land where Abraham first lived, and I tried to ask the question that generations have asked for thousands of years. Can Abraham help heal the world? So let's take a step back at the moment and talk a little bit about who Abraham is and what we know about his life. Now, for those of you who've maybe encountered Walking the Bible or not, or maybe never seen me talk, I want to begin by saying that the entire story of the Hebrew Bible and so much of the story of the ancient Near East takes place on the Fertile Crescent. Now, so many of the stories take place on this arc. So you have the earliest stories in the Hebrew Bible. You've got creation, the Garden of Eden, the Tower of Babel. You have Abraham born here 4,000 years ago. He travels up to Haran, goes forth, as God says, comes down to the Promised Land. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob's son Joseph is sold down into slavery. 430 years, the Israelites live down in Egypt. Along comes Moses, leads the Israelites out of slavery into freedom. They cross the Red Sea. They wander for 40 years in the desert and then trek up the east bank of the Jordan and end on top of Mount Nebo, where Moses dies overlooking the Promised Land. Okay, that's 5,000 years of history in 60 seconds. But let's go back to the beginning of that story. And in so many ways, the story of the Hebrew Bible is the story about the relationship between God and humans as they try to develop a relationship with one another. And the truth is, it doesn't really go that well. Okay? So at the beginning, God takes Adam and Eve. He puts them in the Garden of Eden. And it turns out that Adam prefers Eve to God. And so God gets frustrated and kicks them out of the Garden of Eden. Okay, then the humans are going, they're living along, and then God gets very frustrated, so he decides to send a flood to destroy the world because people are acting in a wicked way. So God taps Noah to save the world. He builds an ark, and then the ark lands, and the families and the animals are all saved, and then Noah starts drinking. He prefers liquor to God. So God, once again, gets frustrated and withdraws. And ten generations from Adam to Noah, and then 10 more generations from Noah to Abraham. Now, when we first meet Abraham, he's 75 years old. He's living in Ur of the Chaldeans. Now, Ur, as many of you know, is in lower southern Iraq today. And I'm a little bit kind of jumping out of my story here to say that a number of years after I worked on my book on Abraham, I went to Iraq in the middle of the war to retrace the biblical stories that take place in Iraq, the Garden of Eden, Babylon, Nineveh, which is where Jonah goes after being swallowed by the whale. All this is described actually in a later book of mine, Where God Was Born. But one of the places that I went to is Ur of the Chaldeans. And Ur is today in southern Iraq, just outside the town of Nasiriyah. And even in all the bombing and the looting, Ur has been largely preserved. And what happened was Saddam actually put an Air Force base immediately next to the ruins of ancient Sumer, in part so that Western airplanes would not bomb the base because they wouldn't want to take the chance of destroying Ur. And the centerpiece of Ur is a ziggurat, which is one of these kind of giant stepped pyramids that they used to build to get closer to the god of the moon and that were later the inspiration for the Tower of Babel. So when I got to Ur a few years ago on this journey I made, I was kind of in my body armor and I'd taken this airplane into Baghdad, and the pilot did this what's called a corkscrew landing to avoid being hit by shoulder-launched missiles, and we kind of land with this smash on the ground in Baghdad, and you put on your body armor and your combat helmet, and for 2 weeks I made this journey all around Iraq. And Ur was one of the first places I went, and it was absolutely took my breath away, because when I had dreamed of going to Iraq, dreamed of walking the Bible, this is where I wanted to go, and I kind of It's safe there now because the coalition forces were stationed at this base that they'd taken over from the Iraqis. And so I took off my body armor, climbed the 121 steps to the top of this ziggurat. And what's powerful about being there, and it's been powerful from so many of my journeys I've made, is that It's very clear that the writers of the Bible were trying to connect their story to the oldest stories in antiquity that predated the Bible, whether it's the story of the ziggurat and or whether it's the story of Sumer, which of course was the first great empire in Mesopotamia, and the biblical writers have Abraham being born there, kind of then transcending it to bring monotheism to the world. There's so many stories about Abraham as a young boy looking up into the sky and looking at the heavens and somehow divining that there was only one God, because of course at the time there would have been a God of the moon and a God of the stars and a God of the water and a God of the trees, and Abraham somehow divines there is one God. And to stand there on top of that ziggurat, and you get the sense that it was built specifically so the humans could climb up and get closer to the heavens, it really shows the connections between the land, between the geography, and between the biblical story. So when we first meet Abraham, he's 75 years old, he's living in Ur of the Chaldeans, and he doesn't have a child. The Bible is a story of creation, and Abraham can't create. And so then God does something fascinating, which is that God reaches out to Abraham, and God can't find a human, Abraham can't find a child, and so God reaches out to Abraham and offers him a deal. On a crisp morning in 1977, I stepped to the pulpit of Mikveh Israel Synagogue in Savannah, Georgia. I was wearing a brand new blue suit and a red tie, and my hair, which alas was still blonde at the time, was kind of neatly tucked over my ears. And I took the Torah from the back of Mikveh Israel Synagogue, which is the third oldest synagogue in the world, and took off the crown and the breastplates and unfurled the Torah on the table, and then took the pointer and read in halting, uncertain Hebrew, Vayomer Hashem El Avram Lech Lecha. It's the opening words of Genesis 12, in which God calls out to Abraham and offers him a deal. Go forth from your native land, God says, and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will bless those who bless you, and curse him that curses you, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by you. At the time, I was 13 years old, and I was reading this passage because my brother had read the same passage at his bar mitzvah, and my mother's maiden name is Abe's house, House of Abraham. Now, nearly everything that God says to Abraham in this passage is remarkable. First of all, he asks Abraham to leave his native land and his father's house. That in and of itself is extraordinary, but then he doesn't even tell Abraham where he's going. But what does he offer in return? He offers not only a son, which of course is what Abraham wants, he offers to make him the father of a great nation, and all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by him. Yet still, Abraham faces a choice. And I think it's a choice that everybody in this room has faced at one time or another. When we look back at what's comfortable and everything we know, and we look forward to some uncertain future, and we have to make the decision, do we make the leap? Do we go on this journey that for some reason we feel called on? Do we make the final step? Do we take the leap? Abraham takes the leap. It's one of the defining moments in human history. All three faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that will eventually come from Abraham's family, consider this moment holy. At the heart of the story, at the heart of the entire Abraham journey, there is common ground. So what happens? Abraham leaves Mesopotamia, leaves the land of the rivers, leaves the land of his family. He comes down to the promised land. There's a famine. He goes down to Egypt. He comes back. At this point, decades have passed, still no son. So what happens? So Abraham's wife, Sarah, takes her handmaid, perfectly legal at the time, takes her handmaid, gives him to Abraham, and Hagar gives birth to a son. Ta-da! Abraham has his child. End of story. But as soon as Ishmael is born, Sarah gets pregnant and gives birth to Isaac. Now we have two sons, rivals for the same land, rivals for their father's heritage, rivals for God's blessing. So what happens? Sarah grows jealous, kicks Ishmael off into the desert. Abraham doesn't want to kick Ishmael into the desert. This is his firstborn son. But God says, don't worry. I'll bless him and all of his descendants as well. This, of course, is the split that we all face today, because Muslims consider themselves descended from Ishmael, Jews and Christians from Isaac. But what's striking about this moment, even though this is a moment in the Hebrew Scriptures, is that God's blessing is as universal as it can become. God blesses Abraham, blesses both of his sons, blesses all of their descendants. At the heart of the story is a clear message of unity. Or is there?
Author Bruce Feiler speaking at the Chautauqua Institution in western New York State. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
The stories in the Hebrew Bible were written down about 2,500 years ago. That's 500 years before the birth of Christ. Abraham would have lived, in all likelihood, 1,500 years before that, 4,000 years ago, 2,000 years before the birth of Christ. And what happened is, even though the story of Abraham is, as I suggested, has this universal message, what happened is that you would think the fact that there's no archaeological evidence, as I said earlier, there's no archaeological evidence that any of these stories ever took place. And you'd think that that would be problematic. But in fact, the opposite happened, because each of the religions that grew out of Abraham's life viewed that as the opportunity. Because each of them kind of elbowed one another aside and tried to make Abraham and claim Abraham for itself. So Jews came first, because of course Judaism came first. And in the early years of Judaism, they said, Abraham is a universal figure. His blessing is open to everyone. But over time, as Judaism began to feel insecure and Judaism began to be oppressed, first by the Romans and then by the Assyrians, Judaism said, you know what? We don't want Abraham to belong to everybody else. We want Abraham to belong just to us. So suddenly Abraham, in the Jewish retelling of the story, Abraham invents Passover, even though Passover doesn't occur until 1,000 years after Abraham would have lived. Abraham starts keeping kosher, the rabbi said, even though kosher wasn't invented until 2,000 years after Abraham lived. The rabbis even say Abraham came to synagogue, even though synagogues weren't invented until more than 2,000 years after Abraham. So what happened was Jews suddenly took Abraham, who was this universal figure, and turned him into a Jew. Now, I have to say, as a Jew, I was kind of horrified to read about this. I mean, what happened to the kind of avuncular Abraham I learned about in bar mitzvah class? Suddenly, he becomes a much more strident Jewish figure. And the door the Jews opened, everyone else came rushing through. So the early years of Christianity, while it was still a sect of Judaism, the Christians said, Abraham, he's open to everyone, not just to Jews, but to Gentiles alike. But over time, as Christianity grows stronger, the Christian commentators began to say, well, actually, you know, never mind. Abraham isn't really a Jew. He really belongs to us. And so suddenly God doesn't promise, in the Christian commentaries, doesn't promise the land to Abraham. He promises the land to Jesus. Suddenly in Genesis 12, in the Christian commentators, God doesn't call out to Abraham to go forth from his native land. He calls out to Jesus to go forth from his native land. So just as Jews turned Abraham into a Jew when he wasn't really that, Christians turned him into a Christian when he wasn't really that either. And guess where the story is going? Along come Muslims 600 years later. In the early years of Islam, while Islam was a very small, vulnerable religion, and Judaism and Christianity were the dominant faiths in Arabia, the Muslims said, actually, you know what? Abraham is open to everybody. He's Jew, Christian, and Muslim alike. But over time, as Islam grew stronger, the Muslim commentators began to say, well, actually, never mind. He doesn't really belong to Jews and Christians. He just belongs to us. So suddenly in the Muslim commentaries, Abraham builds the Kaaba, that big black stone in the middle of Mecca. Abraham calls all Muslims to make the Hajj themselves. So in the way that Jews and Christians, the Jews turned Abraham into a Jew when he wasn't that, and Christians turned him into a Christian when he wasn't that either, Muslims turned him into a Muslim. Let's just take one example. What's the most famous story in Abraham's life? Genesis 22. In the biblical account, God says to Abraham, take your son, your favored one, Isaac, whom you love, take him up to this rock and bind him on the rock as a burnt offering. So Abraham leads Isaac up to the rock, takes the fire with him, takes the wood, and walks up to the rock, binds Abraham to the rock, raises his arm to slay the boy, at which point the angel calls out, okay, now I know that you love God, and it's okay, you don't have to sacrifice Isaac. He finds a ram, he sacrifices that instead. Okay? That story appears in Genesis 22, at which point it disappears from the Hebrew Bible. Nobody else in the entire Hebrew Bible references Abraham and references the near sacrifice. They mention other things about Abraham, but not that story. Maybe they don't like it. Maybe they're uncomfortable with it. Maybe they don't know it. We don't know. The story reemerges in Jewish tradition a few hundred years before the birth of Christ when, as I said earlier, Jews were beginning to be oppressed by all the great powers in the region. Okay? And so they said, well, you know, it's very tough now to be Jewish. Let's go back and look at that story in Genesis 22. I mean, it was like my dad said when I was growing up, you want to be a good Jew kid, you got to learn how to suffer. Well, well, they were suffering, and who is the great example of suffering? It ain't Abraham. They don't care about that. It's Isaac. So suddenly they look at Isaac, and they loved it, and they emphasize the story. Okay? Along comes Christianity. They like this story, but for a different reason, because they see parallels between the story of Abraham and the story of Jesus. Just as Isaac carries the wood up to the binding, so Jesus carries his own cross up to his sacrifice. Just as Abraham takes the ram, finds the ram in a bush, so Jesus wears a crown of thorns. And in the early years of Christianity, when it was trying to suck up to Judaism, the Christians said, this shows that there are great parallels between the story of Isaac and the story of Jesus. But over time, as Christianity grew more powerful, they said, well, actually, you know what the story shows? This shows that God loved Jesus more than he loved Isaac. Because Abraham actually stopped short of killing Isaac, whereas God did not stop short of killing Jesus. So the rabbis begin to hear this story, and they say, well, wait a minute. Actually, you know what? It turns out Abraham did kill Isaac. So in the Jewish commentaries in the Middle Ages, they said Abraham actually did kill Isaac. How do they justify this? They went back to the text, and the angel has to call out twice right before Isaac is being sacrificed. So the commentators said, well, actually, the first time the angel got there a little bit late. So Abraham killed Isaac. Isaac went away for 3 days to heaven and then came back. And then the second time the angel calls out, Abraham hears it, and Jesus and Isaac is miraculously reborn. This story was so popular in the Middle Ages that Jews actually put ashes on their foreheads to commemorate the death of Isaac. And you're beginning to see how the commentaries begin to change over time. Along comes Islam. This story, the story of Abraham nearly sacrificing his son, is repeated in the Quran, but the son is not named. There's some confusion about this, so I'm going to repeat it. The son is not named. Well, which son was it? Well, about half the Muslim commentators said it was Isaac. Why? Because Isaac is in the biblical story. The Bible is a holy book, and so therefore it must be Isaac. The other commentators said, well, no, it's actually Ishmael. How do they justify that? They went back to the text. Take your son, God says, your favored one, Isaac. Well, the Muslim commentators would take your son, your favored one, Isaac. Why does God have to explain to Abraham, which is his favorite son? Take your son, your favored one, Isaac, whom you love, as if Abraham isn't really sure what he feels about Isaac. So they said, take your son, your favorite one, Isaac, whom you love. It's pretty clear, the Muslim commentators said, half of them, that this refers to Ishmael. Jews and Christians were just jealous of Ishmael, so they inserted Isaac into the text in an attempt to make it Isaac. So you had these two Muslim camps. You had the Ishmael camp and the Isaac camp. They battled over time, and over time, for political reasons, the Ishmael camp prevails. So now, if you go on the Hajj and you stop 100 Muslims on the street and you say, which son did Abraham attempt to sacrifice? 100% of them will say Ishmael. But what you see is how what's happening over time begins to affect what we read into the story. And for me, I was incredibly frustrated because it turns out I wasn't just looking for one Abraham. I was looking for 240 different Abrahams, because every generation for every year and through every generation for 2,000 years and the different faiths, each had made an Abraham in its own image. And I was frustrated because I'd worked myself into this incredible knot. And in some ways, it's the knot in the pit of my stomach was the same knot that I'd recognized around me back on September 11th. on one morning, on a cold, rainy Thursday morning in December, I walked up a dark set of stairs in the old city of Jerusalem, through an arch and into a whitewashed room and sat down. At 10:45 in the morning, a man walked in. Sheikh Yusuf Abu Sneina is the imam of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the mosque on top of the Temple Mount. Of course, you've got Solomon built the temple here, Jesus walked here, Muhammad ascended to heaven here. He was this kind of big man, big shoulders, salt and pepper hair, and this big, dark, gray beard. It reminded me, against my will, of Ayatollah Khomeini. I was nervous, he was nervous. This was his first ever interview with a Western reporter. So it was very kind of stilted at first, and I asked him a number of questions, and he gave kind of pat answers. Abraham loved God, and what did he want from God? He didn't want anything from God. He just wanted blessing. And he talked about what it's like to go on the Hajj when you walk around that black stone, the Kaaba, in the middle of Mecca, and you worship God. And he mentioned to me that I asked him if he cried. And he said, well, some people cry tears of joy. Some people cried tears of pain. And I asked him if he cried. And he said, yes, many times. He'd made the journey 5 times. And I said, what did you cry for? I cried for blessing. But eventually I got around to asking him about the essence of the story. And I said, Abraham is the shared ancestor of Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and yet we're fighting over them. He said, if we just follow the text, then we can find peace. I said, but we have different texts. He said, yes, but if you go back and you look at the story in the text, all behind them, they really share the same story. I said, I like to believe that, but I live in New York. People are flying planes into buildings. How can I not feel sadness? You should feel sadness, he said, but you can't let that extinguish your hope. If we go back, if we overlook the details and just look at the principles of the story, you have truth and morality and reconciliation. We can find hope in the shared story of Abraham. Our meeting had come to an end, and we stood up, and I considered embracing him, but I stopped short. The imam of Al-Aqsa Mosque, who had given a fiery sermon earlier on the last Friday of Ramadan, had said that we could use the shared stories of Abraham. That seemed enough of a blessing at the moment. The last thing I did on my journey was set out one morning to Hebron, which, of course, at the time was, and is still in many ways, one of the deadliest cities on the planet. It's in the middle of the Palestinian territories. All the patriarchs are said to be buried there. It is, in some ways, the one place that represents conflict among the Abrahamic traditions, and yet the one place that represents reconciliation. At the time, on the day that I've been there many times, this day that I was there, it was considered so unsafe. The place was empty, and 4 Israeli soldiers with helmets and machine guns, 4, had to escort me up the stairs. Pretty quiet day, I said to the commander. Keep walking, he said. The room between Abraham and Sarah's tombs in the cave of the patriarchs has been turned into this small synagogue. You've got a stack of prayer books. You've got overturned chairs. The walls are painted green. A chandelier hung down from the ceiling. Half the bulbs were out. And it's here in Genesis, in one of the most overlooked passages of the Bible, in Genesis 25:9, that Abraham dies and is buried in the land that he purchased in Hebron. And his 2 sons, Ishmael and Isaac, rivals since before they were born, leaders of opposing nations, great warriors, both of them, come stand side by side and bury their father. Abraham achieves in death what he could never achieve in life, a moment of reconciliation. A side-by-side moment of hope when his 2 brothers stand there, look up at their father, and though there are so many differences that divide them, at the moment, they have so much in common. They are alone. They are mourners. And they look at their father, and they wonder, what have you left me with? What do we do now? When I first set out on this journey for Abraham, as I said, I thought I would find Abraham, and he would be in one particular place. Instead, what I found is that Abraham is in almost every place that I look. Abraham is like this source of underground water that's living just beneath the surface, and generation after generation tap into that source and find an Abraham for their time. And we can too. At the end of my journey, I stood with the questions that so many of us have as we looked at the world in recent years, and that is there a way out? And what I decided to do was that I wanted to put together a way for people to have a first step, grassroots interfaith conversation. And I decided to come up with this program, and I decided to call it Abraham Salons. And what I would do is I put together passages from the Bible and the Quran. I put together discussion questions, and then from my friends at Gourmet, a brownie and a baklava recipe. Triple chocolate, this is what it really said, triple chocolate brownies, one for each religion. So I put together this pack, and I put together this program called Abraham Salons, and I kind of shouted from the mountaintop, I bet we can get 50 to 100 of these things going on around the country. And then I went back home. I said, I'll get my cousins in Vermont and some friends of mine in Baltimore. What happened was that microphone that I hoped I might have got a little bit louder when Abraham appeared, my book appeared on the cover of Time magazine. And in the first couple of weeks, we made 250 of these packets and we sent them out. And then two more weeks later, we made 250 more and we sent them out. And then I mentioned it on C-SPAN one day, and in the next 24 hours, 1,200 people from around the world went to my website and downloaded these packets and began to take a small step and said, I want to do something to help heal the breach in the world. And in the few years after I first put it up there, 5,000 people from around the world downloaded this information. And a year later, one of them sent me an email. And he said, Dear Mr. Filer, I'm an U.S. Army chaplain stationed in Baghdad, and some friends of mine sent me a copy of your book as part of a care package. And I'd like to know if you can send me bulk copies of your book to hand out to the soldiers that I know here and some of the interfaith leaders that I've developed a relationship with here in Baghdad. And then he signed his name, Chaplain Lou Messenger, 1st Armored Division, Baghdad, Iraq. Now, the first thing I thought was, Messenger, great name for a chaplain. And then what we did is we sent a couple of cases of books to Chaplain Messenger. And on this trip to Iraq that I mentioned earlier, I went to see him to the Rusafa base in northern Baghdad. And we went, and one day we had one of these Abraham conversations. There were several dozen U.S. soldiers sitting there. There were some Iraqi Christians and Chaldean Catholics who were working on the base who came. And there was one special guest, the 74-year-old imam from the 14 Ramadan Mosque in Firdous Square in Baghdad. The front door of his mosque is about from here to that wall from where Saddam's statue fell in April in 2003. And the 14 Ramadan Mosque is the one with the blue dome that you see behind CNN and Fox and PBS when they do their stand-ups from Baghdad. So we sat around, we had this conversation. And I have to say, the conversation went far too well. Everybody was getting along and saying nice things, and so at about 20 minutes into this, I interrupted and I said, excuse me, I didn't come all the way to Baghdad to dance kumbaya around some body armor. Can we have a real conversation? And at that point, I invited this evangelical Baptist chaplain if he could ask the toughest question he could think of to the imam. And he asked him a question. He said, you say all these nice things about interfaith relations and how we can get along. And what about the fact that there don't seem to be any moderate Muslims in the world? The extremists seem to be the only people who are speaking for Islam right now. And the imam answered that question and had a few things to say. And then I invited the imam to ask the toughest question he could think of to the chaplain. He says, well, you're saying all these nice things about interfaith relations, but what about the fact that Christians have done far more violence to Muslims over the years than Muslims have done to Jews over the years? The chaplain answered that question, and then I did something that in all the time I spent in Baghdad and a lot of time in the Middle East I have to be careful about, I mentioned out loud that I'm Jewish. And in my line of work, you have to be careful of what I call the Danny Pearl moment. Danny Pearl, a reporter, a Jew, killed, descended actually, his father lived in Israel at the time, killed in many ways for his faith. But I decided under the circumstances, surrounded by the U.S. Army, it was okay, so I said out loud that I'm Jewish, and I asked the imam if he wanted to ask the toughest question he could think of to me. He actually asked me two questions. One, he said, what about the fact that Jews were allowed to worship at the Western Wall far more freely under Muslims than Muslims are now allowed to worship in Jerusalem under Jews? And what about this idea that the Jews killed Jesus? Now, I tell that story not because I want to particularly get into the answer to those questions. Many of you have faced these questions in your lives, but to make a different point, a point particularly poignant, I hope, at the start of your week having interfaith conversation here at Chautauqua. And that is, successful interfaith conversation, if it's going to work, need not just focus on our similarities, but must, I suggest to you, focus on our differences. The task here is not... The goal here is not one religion, okay? It's not some Esperanto mumbo-jumbo where we all hold hands and sing around the campfire and say that we all love butterflies and we cry when we see our children. The goal here is mutual respect. She has her faith, he has his faith, I have my faith. We respect one another, but we don't have to become one another. So at the end of so many years... And to me, I go back to the moment. I have a rule in my life. Whenever I get stuck, go back to the text. And if you go back to Genesis 25:9, what's powerful to me about Isaac and Ishmael is what it doesn't say at their father's funeral. It doesn't say they hugged or had dinner or lived happily ever after. It just says they stood side by side, joined together by mutual love for their father, mutual fear for the future, and a mutual desire to make that family whole again. So I close here by saying, if I've learned one thing in all of my journals, my journeys, it is that we can't sit back and say, I hope they solve that problem over there in Kabul. I hope they figure that situation out in Baghdad, or I hope they get them borders all worked out in Jerusalem. That this question of can the religions get along is so important, it must happen in every neighborhood and in every community and in every heart. So as I thank you for bringing me here to where you're going to have it, I close by saying, why not here? And why not you? Thank you very much.
Bruce Feiler is author of Walking the Bible and Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths. He spoke this summer at the Chautauqua Institution in Western New York State, and you're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After his speech, Feiler took questions from the audience. They were read by Joan Brown Campbell, director of the Chautauqua Institution's Religion Department.
Do you personally hold out hope for the reunion of the family of Abraham?
I mean, here's what I know for sure. What I know for sure is that this is the biggest question in the world today. Can the religions figure out a way to relate to one another that's not by trying to kill one another? And what I feel is that, in some ways, the answer to that question comes back to each of us. But here's one of the ways I look at it. If you go back 100 years ago, okay, this question of the religions seemed to be resolved. Okay? And Christianity basically appeared as if it had won. Okay? Judaism, for the most part, was ghettoized behind walls in Europe. Islam had largely, with the decline of the Ottoman Empire, kind of slunk back into the sands of the Middle East. And Christianity was astride 2, 3, 4 continents. Certainly was astride Europe. It was very strong at the time in North America. Through colonialism, was through much of Africa and even the Indian subcontinent. And Christianity seemed to be the dominant religion. Well, look at what a huge difference 100 years makes. First of all, Judaism, despite what you read in the press, or particularly the Jewish press, is stronger than it's been at any time in the last 2,000 years. Okay, Islam is much stronger than it's been for the last several hundred years, and for a lot of reasons, not least which the rest of the world turns out to work best on Middle Eastern oil. And Christianity is a lot weaker, actually, than it was 100 years ago. In part because colonialism has ended. Each of the former colonial colonies have risen up and have their own religious identity. Europe is obviously in a religious crisis. And even in the United States, Christianity is less strong. So the idea that one religion is going to become the dominant religion, the universal religion, what does Catholic mean, but universal? The idea that one religion is going to become the universal religion is deader now than it's been at any time in the last 2,000 years. So that's point number one. Point number two is, look at the relationship between Jews and Christians. 60 years ago, in the middle of the most sophisticated continent ever created, 6 million Jews were killed because of a combination of secular fundamentalism and Christian extremism. Okay? And now look at what happened, in large part because of the Holocaust, because then of Vatican II and how the Catholic Church had to apologize for its role in discriminating against Jews and even kind of tacitly admit some culpability for the Holocaust. There has been, in the lifetime, In the lifetimes of most of the people in this amphitheater, a wholesale reimagining of the relationship between Jews and Christians. Is it perfect? Is it even great? Let's just say no. But look how dramatically different it has become in one lifetime. Are we there with Muslims? Absolutely not. But I think that 9/11 is proving to be a huge wake-up call into the realize that we have to bring Muslims even into the conversation. The term Judeo-Christian, you know the term that we all kind of throw around? It ain't that old. It's only 50 years old. 100 years ago, America was a Christian nation. The term Judeo-Christian was introduced in large part in the wake of the Holocaust to acknowledge Jewish contribution to Western civilizations. So now what's happened, even in the last 6 years, is the Judeo-Christian conversation has been converted to an Abrahamic conversation. And so I think that while I can't predict the future, I can guarantee you that wholesale change is possible, and I think then the burden falls again back on us.
This questioner asks, understanding the intense interest in Abraham, there are also other faiths. And where would you fit these in?
Well, I'm busy with half the world right now. First of all, what's interesting about that question to me is that it's actually a question that the Jewish commentators were concerned about. As many of you know, Abraham was married to Sarah, had Ishmael and Isaac, and then Sarah dies at 127, and Abraham lives until 175. So there's a several decade gap in which Abraham is a widower, and the Bible says that Abraham remarries a woman named Keturah and has, I think it's 6 sons and maybe a daughter with Keturah. And even the Jewish commentators back in the Middle Ages said that the children of Abraham and Keturah went off and populated the religions of Asia. So there was already a recognition that this problem existed. And I'm sure, I can almost guarantee in a room this size, that somebody will come up to me at the book signing later and say that they are a Baha'i, and the Baha'is, there are 4 million Baha'is in the world, and I've met about 3.5 million of them, they've written to me. And the Baha'is consider themselves descended from a union between Abraham and Keturah. And what many have come up to me and take Abraham, the book is called Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths, and they X off 3 and write 4. So what's interesting is that there was already a recognition to try to bring the Asian religions into the conversation. But the way I would approach it is, what is one of the things that Jews, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam have in common? Beyond Abraham, they are the story of a man who lives in the civilized world, leaves the civilized world to go into the desert, has a transformative experience, then comes back to the civilized world and tells the people in the civilized world what happened to him in the desert. Okay, I'm thinking of Moses, I'm thinking of Jesus, and I'm thinking of Muhammad. And if you look at many of the Asian religions, that's the same story of what happened to the Buddha, that's the same story of Confucius. There's the same kind of general storyline that relates them to these other religions. So I do think that there is an opening as a way to make that conversation happen.
Do you believe that all religions are based on love and faith?
Do I believe that all religions are based on love and faith? Thank you very much for coming. Have a great afternoon.
You just got an urgent call.
No. Yeah, exactly. All my twins just, we're trying to teach them to use the potty and they need instruction. Okay, here's what I believe. I believe that, 30 years ago, if you go back 40 years to the God is Dead cover of Time magazine, there was this idea that religion was going to be dead, and that the simple notion of taking wisdom from ancient sources and applying that to your everyday life was going to be dead as we moved into the future. That science and psychotherapy and EST or whatever was popular at the time was going to be a way for people to reach ultimate peace and happiness and maybe even salvation. I think that what's happened, and as we know, in the last 10 years, there's been a real back to the Bible movement. It's happened both in Judaism. They used to say about Jews that we wrote the book, but we don't have to read the book. There's been a back to the Bible movement among Christians, even among Protestants, who they're going back to the Hebrew Bible and not just the New Testament. Among Catholics, there's been a back. Remember, you could be killed for 1,000 years if you were Catholic, if you actually read the text. In the Middle Ages, thousands of people were put to death because they read the Bible themselves. And now, what is the Catholic Church's response, for example, to the Da Vinci Code? Okay, don't take Dan Brown's word for it. Don't even take our word for it. Go read the text yourself. Okay? So there's this idea to go back to the text. I'm both an example of this and a beneficiary of this, as certainly is Karen Armstrong, much more than me and for far longer than I've been doing it. And what I think is that the texts, the sacred scriptures, and that's the theme of this week at Chautauqua, has, as we all know, different messages that can be taken from it. You can take messages of love and peace, or, if you want, you can take messages of hatred and discrimination. The point is that both messages are in the text. And I think that what's happened in the world today is that we have ceded the conversation to the extremists. So the extremists take the text and hold it up and say, it says this. Okay? Now you're seeing a kind of atheist backlash against the extremists. But really, the only force strong enough to take on religious extremism is religious moderation. Those of us in the big, fat middle. If you look at the surveys, okay, the University of Akron does a study every 4 years. The number of people in America who are evangelical, Protestant, conservatives, this study says, which it identifies as a religious right, is 12.6%. The number of percentage of Americans who are agnostic or atheist is 11.9%. That leaves three quarters in the middle. Those are people who want a relationship with God, want a relationship with text, but struggle. They have doubt. They have questions. And they're trying to figure it out, okay? That is the big, fat middle. And those people have to get over that thing that our mamas all told us, which is don't talk about politics and religion in public. Okay? The extremists do. It's those of us who believe in respect and tolerance. We have to speak out as well. And I think when the extremists hold up the text and say, it says hatred, those of us who believe these other things have to hold up the same text and say you can find the same message in the same text. So it's there, but the other side is there too. We have to call it out and announce it in public.
Thank you, Bruce. Very much.
Bruce Feiler, author of Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths, and Where God Was Born. He is host of the PBS series Walking the Bible. It's based on his book of the same name. Feiler spoke this past summer in upstate New York as part of a week-long program on the Abrahamic tradition held at the Chautauqua Institution. If you missed part of this hour's speech by Bruce Feiler, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. In addition to hearing this week's show, you may subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including another recent speech on the role of religion in the world from Sam Harris, author of The End of Faith. Next week on Word for Word, we begin a two-part series on the stump in Iowa and New Hampshire. It'll feature speeches from the candidates seeking the Democratic and Republican nominations for president. That starts next week with highlights from the Republican candidates' stump speeches. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Sam Keenan. American Public Media.